time we just started the second chapter. And I'll remind you of what we said. We're talking about the categories by which the world is run. Categories which are available in principle to anybody. And in principle, everybody could end up in one category or another, or people could split. These are the general categories by which the world is run. The first thing he says is that because we have free will, each person can choose to do good or choose to do evil, or some of each. But evil actions leave a residue in the soul and in the body, in the person. And that residue sets up a barrier to connection to God, to experiencing God. And since the world to come is supposed to be perfectly good, there can't be any such barriers in the world to come. Indeed, there can't be any evil at all. And since evil is God being hidden, so there can't be any hiddenness in the world to come. God has to be open, free, accessible. So, when a person performs bad actions, and those bad actions have this residue, that residue has to be eliminated. That's one principle. Second principle is that each action gets compensated separately. There's no balancing effect. The person does 100 good things, 7 bad things, can't just end up with 93. There's no canceling out effect. Each action gets its own compensation. So, if you have a person who qualifies to go to the world to come, there has to be a mechanism before he gets there to wipe out the residue of his failures, of his crimes. If you have a person who is not qualified for the world to come, his record is so black that he can't exist in the world to come, then there has to be some way of compensating him for the good things that he's done. So the general picture then, he says, is this. There are 2 periods. This world and the next world. The majority of your actions, and that word will be qualified in subsequent progress, but for now, just for a simple first pass, the majority of your actions determine your position vis-a-vis the world to come, and the minority of your actions are taken care of here. So, a person whose majority of actions are good and qualifies for the world to come, that majority is rewarded in the world to come. The minority of bad actions, which create that residue, have to be taken care of before he gets there. For the other category, person whose actions are so consistently bad that he doesn't qualify for the world to come, he has to be compensated for those minority of good actions that he did, and that compensation will take place here. And then, Mutata points out that already you can begin to see an answer to the question why righteous people suffer and why wicked people prosper, because the righteous people are people who are going to go to the world to come, but whose minority of bad actions have to be taken care of, and they will suffer. And the wicked people can be those who are so wicked that they've lost the world to come, but justice requires that the few good things they have done need to be rewarded, and so they're rewarded here, and that's why they will prosper here. In fact, the Ramban goes so far as to put it in the form of a riddle. imagine a person who on Rosh Hashanah is decreed for death. He doesn't deserve to live out the coming year. Says the Ramban, it is possible that that person will perform after Rosh Hashanah a terrific crime, a terrible crime, and the result of the terrible crime is that the decree will be overturned and he will live out the following year. How could it be that a terrific crime will enable the person to live out the year when the original decree was that he should die? How could doing something bad have a good effect? It says Ramban, imagine a person whose balance of good and bad actions qualifies him for the world to come. He's going there. And, given all the other factors, this year, 6 months of this year should be the end. Now let's imagine he performs a terrific crime. A crime so terrible that he has changed his balance and he no longer deserves the world to come. Now he doesn't deserve the world to come, but what about all the good things that he did? They have to be rewarded. And it could very well be, says Ramban, there isn't enough time in the coming year to reward him for all the good things that he's done. In that case, he's got to live more than the coming year. And he will live out the year. Which shows you, I'm adding as a footnote, an important footnote for you to know, that when you read in rabbinic sources about decrees from heaven, they're not absolute. They're not absolute. They can be overturned by extraordinary circumstances. We're not fatalistic in that way. Free will is strong enough to overturn even what are called decrees from heaven. But anyway, you see now how this principle works, that the minority of actions get their appropriate response here, and the majority determine the person's condition in the world to come. You with me so far? Mm-hmm. Now, there are at least two problems here. The smaller problem is the Talmud says, Schar b'hayah malekeh, there is no reward in this world. The question will be, how can those people who are not going to the world to come be rewarded in this world for their good deeds if the Talmud says there is no reward in this world? Let's work on this a little bit. Let's clarify. There's no reward in this world. My goodness, every day, twice a day, you read the Shema. And in the second paragraph of the Shema, it certainly sounds like reward and punishment. It says there that if you keep the commandments, do what I command you, then things will go well. And if you violate the commandments, things will go ill to the point even of exile. What does the Talmud mean when it says there's no reward in this world? Maimonides, in Hilchos Tshuva, raises this question and he gives the following answer. You have to distinguish between reward on the one hand and investment on the other. Here's the difference. Let's say you have a job and you signed a contract. The contract says if you work 40 hours a week, you can pay $2,000 at the end of the week. Now, you come at the end of the week with your overseer's worksheet, which says you were there for 40 hours. And you come to the paymaster and say, here, look, I worked for 40 hours, here's my contract, give me the $2,000. That $2,000 is reward. You have earned it. It's yours by right on the basis of your performance. You have a claim to it. In justice, it cannot be denied. That's reward. On the other hand, let's suppose you go to the bank and you ask for a loan of $100,000 to set up a business. They will want to know your business history. Have you run successful businesses before? Do you have a business degree? Do you have collateral? If they decide to give you the loan, they will do it on the basis of your past performance. But your past performance has not earned this loan. They don't owe you this loan. This loan is an investment in your future. It's not compensation for your past. Now, says Maimonides, all the promises that we have in the Torah of responses in this world to our performance are promises of investment or withdrawal of investment. They have nothing to do with reward and punishment. God says, if you follow my commandments, then you are showing yourselves to be worthy of future investment, then I will give you benefits as an investment in your future practice, performance. This is not meant as compensation. So the promises of good and bad things happening to people, if they keep it, if they don't keep it, this has nothing to do with reward and punishment. It has to do with providing investment or withdrawing investment based on your performance. The Talmud statement that reward is only in the world to come holds. With me so far? Yes? So now we're in trouble, right? Why are we in trouble? Because 7 minutes ago we said, what did we say? That the bad guy who's not going to the world to come is going to be rewarded for his actions in this world. And we are now saying that there is no reward in this world. A little deeper. Why is there no reward in this world? What's the reason behind it?
Is it like two good friends? Like a small example I can think of is if you go on a bus and give them a £50 note, you're not going to get change. So like the reward is too good to give you this world.
Yes, I think that's right. A mitzvah is an expression of the soul. And the soul is not an item of this world. The soul transcends this world. We spoke about this a little bit. The soul is not bound by space and time. The soul is a piece of God on high. God breathed it into us from his innermost depths, so to speak. There is enough benefit in this world, the whole of this world, to compensate for one mitzvah. Because it's apples and oranges. The quality of a mitzvah is such that this world is not the right kind of compensation. It'd be like saying, you saved my life, I give you an unlimited budget for candy. You know, all the candy in the world doesn't begin to compensate for saving somebody's life. It's just not the right kind of compensation. It's not on a par with the action that's been performed, the value that's been created. So, if the Talmud says that there's no reward in this world, and if the reason for it is that this world can't compensate for a mitzvah, how then do we say that these superbly worked wicked people, people who are not going to make it to the world to come, can be paid off for their mitzvos in this world? Now, I don't have what I think is a really good answer to that question. I don't have a really good answer. I heard an answer, and I'll share it with you. I'm not sure whether the answer is fully serious, or maybe it's a little bit of a joke. But I'm looking for a better answer. Here's what I heard some people say. This wicked person, let's imagine that he's talking on the telephone, and it's coming to time for mincha, afternoon prayers, coming close to sunset. He's on the phone with a business deal. It occurs to him, I really want to talk mincha, but you know, if I cut off this telephone call, I could lose $2,000. So he debates in his mind, and he says, no, I'm skipping mincha. Okay, he has put a price on mincha. For him, mincha is not worth $2,000. That's his price on mincha. Okay, so now God says, how many times did you have a mincha? 1,000? Okay, so I'll give you, $2 million. You're paid off. You're paid off at your own price. You are willing to trade mincha for $2,000, so I'm paying you $2,000 per mincha. You have no complaint, because you gave it up for that. So you're paying the guy in terms for which he has no complaint. Because he's already traded away mincha for less money than that. I'll tell you what bothers me.
What about the other way?
What do you mean?
If you're doing something, you should, instead of just standing, we don't know how much we're going to get anyway. So for him, we take it to him for the bad. But to us, we don't use ourselves for the good, let's say the good for the good, how much we appreciate it.
You mean we who are going to Olam HaVo?
Yeah, we don't. if you're going to use that, then you should turn it the other way around, and we're closing on involved in that kind of thing at all. It's something completely.
I mean, there's too many pronouns here. There's that kind of thing, and good for good, and bad for bad, and I'm
saying it's bad, guys. You're saying, well,
yeah.
This has worked to you,
that's
I'm
right.
going to do that.
Right.
But if somebody does something positive.
Who's somebody? Which somebody?
A Jew.
Ain't you even the one who's not going to go to Olam Haba?
No, the ones who are doing.
So the ones who are yes going to go to Olam Haba.
Yes, yeah. We're not at all figuring it out compared to what they understand it to be.
Okay, the truth is, there is a condition under which it will work there too. That's coming up a little later, but not today, but we'll get to it today. There is a case for a Jew who is going to Olam Haba for that to happen also. Possibly, yeah. It could happen. It could happen. It doesn't always happen. It doesn't always happen this way, yeah?
Well, when you say about reward and investment, they're not the same thing. Would an investment be like a reward which has the potential of creating further misfortune?
No.
Like, say you're given $50 and hopefully you're going to use that, say, give it up or something like that.
A reward might be used as an investment. It might even be expected that a reward will be used as an investment. But there's a big difference because a reward is something that I have a right to. I can claim. It's mine. I earned it. An investment is not like that. I have no right to an investment.
But how would you explain an investment?
An investment is where I have proven myself a good bet that my future performance will give back returns on the investment.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, like, if you sort of are just, like, somehow given $50.
Yes.
And, like, you're expected that this $50 should go to something good, not to yourself.
Okay.
Isn't that like the investment?
That could be like an investment. Just don't use the word reward now.
Yeah.
That's not a reward anymore. And the difference between them philosophically is a reward looks to the past. A reward is justified by the past. I worked, I earned it, you gave it to me. This chapter is closed. It's finished. I earned it, you paid me, and the scales are balanced. Whereas an investment, when I get the money, that opens the books. To balance the scales, I have to use that investment and make a profit.
So
that looks to the future. Investment looks to the future, reward looks to the past. Yeah.
For your previous example to hold, the mid-paid $2,000, then righteous people should be encouraged to put themselves in a situation where, say, you have a flight to take and a friend rings you up and says, just learn one word of Torah with me, and you go to his house and you do one word of Torah, you miss your flight. It costs you £1,000 to change that flight just for one word of Torah. Therefore, you equate that one word to that, and then you multiply that up by.
Yeah, but listen again. He really raised this in his question. We're talking now about a person who's not going to the world to come. We're talking about 0.001% of the population. Right? We're trying to explain. Let's go back and put it in the background again. We're trying to explain how a rule in the Talmud could have an exception. The rule was there is no reward in this world altogether. All the reward comes in the world to come. The reason is because there's expression of the soul transcends this world altogether. All the benefit in this world could not possibly begin to pay for even one mitzvah. It's apples and oranges. It's like candy for saving somebody's life. Now we're told, but there's this 0.001% who really are going to get paid in this world. So we say, it's a contradiction. How could that be? For that exception to the rule, we're saying those few people who are going to be paid off in this world, against the rule in the Talmud, the justification is that they priced it at that price.
But surely this 0.001% wouldn't be going to mitzvah anyway.
Well, either if so, then there's no problem at all, right? We're trying to pay them off for the mitzvahs that they've done. If they haven't done any mitzvahs, then there's no problem to raise in the first place. The problem only arose because this 0.001% did some mitzvahs. And now they have to be paid for them. If they didn't do any mitzvahs, the problem doesn't arise. So you have to figure this guy, davens 22 mitzvahs in his lifetime. Now, and in right, he says, in justice, I did those mitzvahs, I should be paid for it. So the question is, how will we pay him? He's not going to the world to come to get paid. So how is he going to be paid here? And the answer is, we pay him in his own coin. Let's see what he traded mitzvah for. Whatever he traded mitzvah for, that's his price on mitzvah. If that's his price on mitzvah, we'll pay him that price, and he has no complaints. What bothers me is, what do I care whether he has complaints? Why don't we have complaints? In other words, why isn't justice insulted here? Okay, so I've tracked him where he can't lodge a complaint. So what? But abstractly, if the reward doesn't fit the action, then whether he can complain or not, you know, justice ought to complain that he's not being paid for the action that he performed. Yeah.
Why can't we call this reward to be the same investment, but in this case it has been misused by the wicked person? He's given not a reward, but he's given an investment according to the situation that he is in. He requires more hesed from Hashem. Hashem gives him more to overdo his wicked deeds that he's done in his life. And he misuses this option, this opportunity. By receiving and not using it the right way. I mean that he simply does not know how to use it. This is another question, but I think it also could be called an investment.
I'm not sure how what you're saying connects with what I'm saying. Let me go back again and say the difference again, and let's see if we can agree on that. By my definition, a reward is something that you earned. You have a right to it. You have a claim on it. When you are paid it, the books are balanced. You worked and you got paid. Everything is satisfied at this point. There are no loose ends. Everything is satisfied. If history ends here, everything's fine. With investment, when you receive the money from the bank, history is not over. It's just starting. You received money in order to generate a profit. If history stops here, then somebody is owed. There's something wrong. Something hasn't been paid up. So in logic, there's a gigantic difference between a reward and an investment. An investment is justified by the past. I'm sorry, a reward is justified by the past. An investment is justified by what will happen in the future. If the future doesn't happen, then the giving of the money turns out to be a crime.
Maybe by being given this let's say investment, his whole future could be different.
Okay, but now our question that we're dealing with is mitzvot he's already done. If he's already done them, then he is owed a reward. Now how can we pay him off? If the reward only works in the world to come, and he's not going to the world to come, how is he going to be paid? Investment's out of the picture now. What's now is we owe him. God owes him for the mitzvah that he's done. So how is he going to be paid? And the answer is he's paid in this world. How can he be paid in this world? He's paid at the value that he has put on the mitzvah himself. That's that. I'm not totally satisfied with this, but that's what they say. Yeah.
It doesn't sound so far-fetched because don't just say judge everybody favorably. This way you'll be judged favorably. Mm-hmm. If you judge people harshly, you'll be judged harshly. It just sounds like justice. It sounds like.
Okay, the others who want to add in here, why isn't he going to the world to come? Because by his own actions, he has destroyed his capacity to appreciate the world to come. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like this. Imagine that the world to come is music. You know, Bach, Beethoven, Franz, Berlioz, and Bartok. Right? That's pretty good. I was throwing Mozart, actually, even if it isn't B. But you're given instructions. In this world, don't turn up the volume too strong, because if you do, then you're going to ruin your eardrums. And of course, you have these people with these boom boxes, you know, and the people who wear the earphones, and you sitting 10 feet away can hear everything that they're listening to. And you're ruining your ears. You know? Oh, yeah, but they're 18. What do they care about ruining their ears? Now, imagine a person who deafens himself by doing that in this world, and then it's a question of going to the world to come. But all the world to come is Bach, Beethoven, Berlioz, Brahms, and Bartok, you know. Shalom Aleichem. So if he's ruined his own hearing, he's not going to be able to appreciate it. It's not a punishment so much as he has disqualified himself by ruining his own capacity to appreciate. If so, then the question of compensation in the world to come is out of the question. He himself has ruled it out for himself, so this is the second best. Again, he has no complaint because it's paid off according to the value that he himself understands. That's what I said was the minor question. The more serious question, and for this we'll really have to work hard. What about the person who is going to the world to come, but his transgressions have left a blemish on his soul, which make it impossible for him to appreciate God, to communicate with God, to be cognizant of God, So that blemish has to be removed. How is it removed? All the sources agree that suffering can remove it. Suffering can remove it. There is a difference of opinion whether suffering is necessary to remove it. Some say yes and some say no. The Ben Yon and the Shari Tshuva says no. But everybody agrees that suffering can remove it. Now, I haven't seen anyone ask what to me is a question that's really very disturbing. How does suffering do it? Why is suffering relevant? What's the natural connection? This guy didn't give charity. Okay, that's unjust. That's a transgression. He's misusing the funds that God made available to him. It's a crime. Why would suffering be the right way to rectify the blemish on his soul that he committed, that he received, that he caused in himself by not giving charity? That guy violated the laws of Shabbos. So again, why would suffering be relevant to removing that blemish? I believe that if the sources had said something else, that it is extra charity that takes off the blemish, or study of Torah that takes off the blemish, or saving people's lives that take off the blemish, we'd have been just as happy. No one would have said, oh no, it's got to be suffering, intuitively. We never would have thought of it. And all the sources agree that suffering does the job. And I haven't seen, this could be just my ignorance, although I've asked many people, I haven't seen anywhere a full explanation of why suffering is a right therapy, let alone the only right therapy, but even why it's right at all. To me, it could be portrayed as apples and oranges. The person did something wrong, and now he's going to suffer. So what? Even if you say, like some people do, look, you got some pleasure out of the crime, didn't you? So you have to pay for the pleasure with pain. I didn't even understand that. Why is suffering pain a way for paying for the pleasure? Suppose it had said the opposite. You got an illicit pleasure, provide pleasure for people who deserve it. That's how you compensate for it. You got bad pleasures, provide people with good pleasures. If the sources had said that, everybody would have been happy. No one would have raised the question and said, oh no, you're providing other people with pleasure. You've got to get rid of the pleasure with pain. I don't think anybody would have thought of it. So when the source is right, the pain is at least one relevant way to remove the blemish of the soul, I don't think that's obvious at all. And I'm a little, you know, I'm a little surprised that I haven't found anywhere in the sources that explain it. I have thought up an explanation based on Gusato's general principles, and I will share that with you shortly. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to say, I can't say in every case, but I think sometimes it's something may be able to help people realize what they're doing wrong and possibly to shiva.
Okay. This is very important. He's suggesting that the suffering will enable the person to go through a different rehabilitation process. Shuva is for sure it's a rehabilitation process. And maybe the suffering itself isn't the therapy. Maybe the suffering isn't itself what cleanses the blemish on the soul. No, it just stimulates the person to go through the real therapy, which is tshuva. You're definitely right that suffering, some suffering, has as its purpose stimulating the person to do tshuva. But Ramchal himself says that the therapy in the tshuva is the suffering in the tshuva, because part of tshuva is regret, regretting what I did. And he says, you've got to have suffering as the therapy for the blemish. But the Ramchal's position is that when you do tshuva and you regret what you did, and when you experience regret, it is a deep pain. And it's a lasting pain. And it's a pain, if the crime is significant, it'll last you your whole life. You'll think back on a thing, and that wince in your guts. Oh, why did I do that? Why did I? I shouldn't have done that. Right? And that's the therapy in the tshuva. The therapy in the tshuva is the pain in the tshuva, says Ramchal. So we're not going to get out of it that way. Yeah.
How do you explain the fact that some people don't actually, it takes them further away from doing tshuva when they suffer?
Yes, it is true that the pain is not a guaranteed therapy. That is true. It's an attempted therapy. If you'll ever deal with psychology or psychologists, you'll find, actually even in surgery, there's no guarantees. But in psychology, you know, there's no guarantees that it works even half the time. You try. You try your best. You try a strategy for dealing with a person and helping him improve, and either he takes it or he doesn't. Now, one condition on the suffering, functioning as therapy, is that the person should receive it in a religious spirit. Should say, I know that God means this for my good. As we say in Yiddish, Dozayna Kapara, let it be an atonement for the things that I have done wrong. So he should receive it, at least as that, as something which can be therapy for him. And if he doesn't, then he compounds his problems. He doesn't benefit from it. But my question is the other side. How can it benefit him? How can it do him any good? Why is it relevant to the blemish that's left over from the crime?
Well, I heard this idea that the suffering, whatever, there's not really a connection. It's not necessarily true that there's a connection. Rather, there's a period in the next world, right at the beginning, right after death, where there's like a purification process for everyone, and then so then everyone can enter the world, the next world, in a pure state at least.
Okay, I'll fill in a little of the details, and then I want to go to the explanation. I think it's agreed upon by the sources that there are three possibilities for this therapeutic suffering. It could either be in this world, or as you say, the threshold of the next world, or both. And different crimes will require different types of attention. So the doors are open for a variety of these matters. If you do tshuva, then you're guaranteed you leave this world clean. That's the great benefit of tshuva. If you do tshuva, you're guaranteed you leave this world clean. Although there may be some suffering in this world, but when you leave this world, you're clean. If you don't do tshuva, then it could be that in the entry to the next world, you will need a further therapeutic cleansing process, which will be also bound up in suffering. But it still leaves over my question, why is the suffering relevant? Yeah.
I can't
quite
answer the question.
Okay.
As I understand the concept that Rahal arises in some other books, his books, he says that as we know that body is only like a shell for the soul, since soul has its own goal in this world to come, in this world, and it has a certain, and it rules the body, and the body follows the soul for a certain extent.
You mean the soul follows the body? What did you mean?
I mean that soul rules the body,
soul rules the body.
But in this world, so, and you know that there is a connection between body and soul.
Okay.
Since the older, since the older rivers, they have a certain effect and impact on the soul. It reveals in the body. So.
Okay. Okay, but So, in a way, what you're doing is taking the first step. How can suffering have any effect at all? I agree with you. I agree with what you said. My question is, everything that happens to the body has an effect on the soul, and vice versa. They interact, right? Why is this particular process in the body the process that removes the blemish, which enables the person to experience God? Okay, I'm going to give you what I think is relevant here. Simple, it's not. I'll do my best to explain it. Let's talk about deliberate transgression. So, the person has A and B in front of him. A is right, B is wrong. He knows this. He considers, he deliberates, he experiences his temptations, and then he chooses wrong. Now, what's involved in choosing something? Anything. To choose something, you have to have some motivation to want it. We spoke about this. Free will is only when you have motivation pulling you in different directions. So there is a motivation. Let's say A is the wrong choice. There's a motivation that pushes it naturally in the direction of A. There's another motivation pushing him in the direction of B. And then he has the ability of choice, which chooses between. To be motivated for A means that part of the person sees in A something good. something valuable, something desirable, something attractive. Part of him responds to A. Part of him values A. Another part values B. There's a struggle between them, and then there's choice. But part of him values A. Let's look at that part. The part of him that values the wrong thing. Let's ask for its point of view, so to speak. Its point of view, its philosophy. It values A. It sees A as something desirable, even though it's forbidden. Who forbade it? Who made it forbidden? Who said not to take it? God. Okay, so what's the point of view of this motivation for A? The point of view of the motivation for A is, A really had something desirable in it, but God said no. I want it. I want it because there's something there that's valuable. It's just that God said not to take everything that's valuable. Not to take everything that's desirable. Certain valuable, desirable things God said not to take. From the point of view of this part of me that desires A, the forbidden A, A is good. A has in it something valuable. But God said, don't take it. God said, don't take it. There's something good that God said not to take. Well, what kind of God is that? What kind of God is it that would put something into the world, something that's good, and say, don't take it? This is a God who would deprive me of something good. Or, flip it around, if God really is good, all good, and He provides good and wants good for me, and He says no for A, it seems to me that A is good, then A must be coming from someplace else. A must be coming from some other agency. Otherwise, why would God say no? This part of me that values A does not see in A God as the source of all good. It doesn't see God there. Because if this part of me saw God in A as forbidden, it would have to give up its impression that there's anything good there. Again, if God is all good, and He is all powerful, and He's the only creator, and He says no, then there's no good in it at all. There isn't any good in it. So how come this part of me is attracted to it? This part of me is attracted to it means that it's responding to it as something good. And that can't be. So this part of me is suffering from an illusion. It's suffering from the illusion that there is something good and God says no. As if God would want to deny me something good. Which would mean that God isn't wholly good, doesn't want the best good for the person. Okay, now the truth is, as we have said, in order for there to be free will, part of me has to be attracted to A. So I have to have built into me. This is what I'm telling you now is different from the way I've said it before, because last time a student challenged me, and I had to refine it, so I took a step last time. There has to be built into me a good inclination and an evil inclination, and the evil inclination has to respond to evil in desire, and therefore has to treat it as if it had some good in it. It has to be subject to this illusion that there is a good which God is saying no to. That's necessary part of my makeup in order for me to have free will. But if I act on it, then my will is agreeing with the illusion. And the will is a much higher element in the person. The will is a much deeper element to the soul than merely the evil inclination, which is really associated with the body, mostly. So by acting on this illusion, I have sort of uploaded that illusion to a much higher level in my identity, and I have thereby contaminated that higher element of my identity. I've contaminated it by importing into it the illusion that there could be a good that God denies. If there's a good that God denies, then God isn't in that good. Its goodness comes from elsewhere. God isn't there because he told me not to take it. And yet it is good. So the goodness didn't come from God. It's got to be coming from something else. The root failure here is a philosophical failure. The inability to see God everywhere. Now those who have heard of the Das Tunos, the Understanding Heart, I'm bringing in this, the whole theme of that book applies right here. God has been siphoned out of that item. Bacon cheeseburgers. What could be wrong with a bacon cheeseburger? I mean, okay. Full cholesterol. I'll do another round on the treadmill. We'll work it out. But the guy said, no bacon cheeseburgers. So if the person eats a bacon cheeseburger, his will is saying, there is a good here that God told me not to have. And that good means that God isn't in that good. That good comes from someplace else. It's a failure of seeing God everywhere in the world. Okay. Now, I want to use an idea from Tesla to explain how pain comes into it. Tesla, in his essay on trust and endeavor, talks about people who are addicted to nature. By addicted to nature, I mean they have to see everything as natural. They pretend that natural law covers every event. They pretend that this is known, that scientists have proven this, that's the farthest thing from the truth, but that's what they pretend. Even when very unusual, unpredicted, unexpected events happen, they say, there must be an actual cause, I'm sure it was just factors we haven't discovered yet. Like George Miller said about the origin of life, when the Scientific American interviewed him in 1991, the 8 going theories for origin of life, all of which are terrible. They said to him, Professor Miller, would you consider the possibility of God? And he said, absolutely not. We're making a mistake. We haven't explained it. We've got it wrong, but we'll get it right. God is not an option. Not an option. So here, God has been factored out of this part of the world. Now, says Rav Dessler, if a person has a fixation on something, and you want to break the fixation, in some cases, pain will do it. If the thing, the object of the fixation, causes the person pain, after a certain amount of time, the pain will be enough to break the fixation. The standard example of this is infatuation. A person's infatuated with somebody, and the object of the infatuation uses the person coldly and cruelly, knowing the person is in the grip of a very powerful emotion. And the onlookers look at the victim and they say, she's using you, you know. In her eyes, you're dirt. She's just using you for her purposes, and he can't see it. His eyes are full of stars. And you know, no, she'll turn around, it'll change. But after being cut by her over and over and over again, after a while, it gets to him. And it breaks him. So Nessa says, this is his fourth category out of five, and a person who's in love with nature and who has a fixation on explaining everything naturally, even in the most unusual cases, one way to get to him is for nature to cause him so much pain that in his desperation, he looks for something else. He looks elsewhere. Pain can break a person's fixation on an illusion. That's what Rav Dessler says. Now, I'm suggesting we import that idea here. We're talking about a person whose will has become contaminated with the illusion that there is something good in the forbidden action. How can you break that illusion? The illusion is not to see God in that, not to see God in that forbidden action. To see that as having some good which God says no, doesn't allow you to have. The answer is, if you can see that choosing that action causes pain, if you can see that pain comes out of that choice, then the person can be led to reconsider. So maybe it wasn't good. Maybe that choice that I made, based on the assumption that there is good here to be had, just God said not to have it, that was a mistake. Really, it wasn't good. Just as in ordinary life, when a person makes a decision and later sees the consequences, he often says, oh, I see now that it was a mistake. And so here also, it could be a way of breaking that fixation. And since this kind of fixation is going to be a barrier to perceiving God, because it's going to mean that the person on the level of his will, which is a high level of the soul, that person has already divided up the world into God and not God. So part of him doesn't see God where God really is. That itself is a barrier to being able to appreciate God. So that has to be broken. That's my suggestion. Now, what I suggest is you sit on that for 23 hours, and tomorrow I'll say it again. I'll see if you have any observations on it. That's the best that I know how to do to explain why suffering is relevant.